Blog Talk Radio.
Bring to is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the Continental Morning of former Tanzanian President John Magufuli, who passed away just several days ago. Hundreds of young people are joining the ruling Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party in this Southern African state. Sectional conflict is continuing in the southern regions of Ethiopia amid growing interference from the United States. And African migrants are still losing their lives in the Mediterranean in attempts to relocate in Europe. In the second hour, we reviewed news reports from Africa and the international community. Finally, we continue our focus on International Women's History Month through an audio documentary on life and times of Ruby Elsie. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Lianda, sama mako vida, dijo shiradi, boti mako ungu. Imoto pio, mbaya yori dina, majaliana, yoti yoti paro. Mbaya yori joi, matimi yuana, ya koro bibore. Shirati, oh we know that for the banda jodi. Newa yudo, love makaparo, yo junyo kuyo, dey makoje. Kwa inema, kiwinja fada, konyo pia jei. Zamba ya uo gironga, wate chokoturu, jeiyo mino chienko, wate chokoturu. Zamba ya usie poviga, wate chokoturu, jeiyo yora kelu, wate chokoturu. Mbaya omino wino, wate chokotu, otingo wako jipiju, wate chokotu, wayudo josi koti duina, yoro wako wabimo. Thank you. Lilian Jackie Seru Josio Imotora Pudo Polina Siri Jose Choponyari Goke Jinikanye Polina Jabe Paparori Owino Magumba Koda Sos Nyadi Kivoli Korina Koda Musolete Imotora Pudo Nyari Goke Japoli Jabe Mama Oke Koa Wangiora Pudo Polina Owino Jopa Koko Da Sos Nyadi Polino No Nyiri Kodi Ler Mare Wa Oro Nimos Oke Koa La cane wane no rock, mapolo timo nyari goke nyako, owino jopa kokane wati wolos, wamor turu, polina wa, omiyo sani, wa oro nimo, polina rapudo, oke koa, irito welo nyaka wagogo turwa, wa turu, wadonyo gimo, rito chako wero wendi, nyaru mama polina wa, Jabera Luri Oke Koa Ito Chako Wero Wendi Nyaru Mama Polina Wa Jabera Luri Oke Koa Barua Moro Ya Nioro Mwenwango Kili Nairobi Mwenyiso Kili Nieroe
Kili,
siwonwale ni mona chopoli esi Tomo vino viero ki ese kiel nyitambe jomwa puto kodo eori
Kinde maya ni somo
Nina, Womong Matifu, Odero, Oda Wate Magie, Oda Wano.
Thank you.
go wino moso wa jeni nyabi tondi nyashirati. Keno kebo kelo yuwe were abyamo maka jono rito eno. Tuli nyago wino moso wa jeni nyabi tondi nyashirati. Keno kebo kelo yuwe were abyamo maka jono rito eno.
Yo si lleva vender o tinder. Ganja Magunga. Yawichuo.
Linda, linda piruefo, linda linda piruefo, nyaga rura, akudo lien katoya.
Listo. beti batu yo chunya rapoto neni nywele yako ni ya kizungu mpenzi wangu asiti
Na wacho kutuwa, wino ne wacho kuhika wana. morgo nyango Simayo mine isebo rako Wao wino ne wachoko ikawana Kindone wa morgo nyango Simayo mine isebo rako Wao wino ne wachoko ikawana Komiyo ya wama kawono Kawuchoko tuba Umoto mine isebi kora joni
sioniyo kwa makopita magunga wakodo wino mitiani papara keyo nyarodingo sivie papari sani kisolo tatingi maginyari kundo yoriye sama para keyo nyarkade Kuyo parolala, nike jateo mimana
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and that was music from the East African state of Tanzania. Shirati Jazz Music, the Ikwo Kiroko hits from the East African state of Tanzania from the 1970s. And right now we're going to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And our lead story deals with the ongoing mourning process in the United Republic of Tanzania, where President John Magufuli passed away just 5 days ago. According to an article in today's Zimbabwe Sunday Mail, President Mnangagwa has described the late president of Tanzania, John Pombe Magufuli, as a dedicated Pan-Africanist who championed the removal of illegal sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe by the West. President Magufuli succumbed to heart complications just this last past Wednesday at the age of 61. Speaking during a handover ceremony of a utility bus he donated to the Shambani Vocational Training Center at State House in Harare on Saturday, President Mnangagwa also congratulated Tanzania's new president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, on her assumption of office. The president will today travel to the East African country, where he will join fellow Southern African Development Community leaders attending the funeral of a late statesman ahead of his burial, which will take place later today, Monday, March the 22nd. It was a very sad news. It came as a huge shock to me personally because of my personal relationship with the late President Magufuli. That's according to President Mnangagwa. He said that President Magufuli was supportive of Zimbabwe. We have been under sanctions for 2 decades, but when he became SADC chairperson, he is the one who proposed that at the SADC region we must take a stand against the sanctions. Under his chairmanship, October the 25th was set aside as a day on each year that the bloc will protest against the sanctions and that they must be lifted by those who impose them against us. In 2019, the Southern African Development Community Heads of State and Government Summit in Dar es Salaam proclaimed October 25th as a day of solidarity with Zimbabwe against sanctions, with regional countries committing to hold events annually on the day in their respective countries until the punitive measures are lifted. The bloc's secretariat was tasked to coordinate a regional drive through its diplomatic channels to exert pressure on the West to relent and remove the sanctions. President Mnangagwa described President Magufuli as a great friend of Zimbabwe's, whose death will be felt throughout the region. And other developments in Zimbabwe, at least 450 Harare youth officially joined the ruling ZANU-PF party as the party's youth wing intensified its mobilization drive ahead of the 2023 harmonized elections. And the party's provincial youth leadership received some of the new members at the welcoming ceremony at the party's provincial headquarters. The youth were recruited through social media campaigns over the last 3 weeks, addressing the new members. ZANU-PF Harare Province Youth Chairperson Comrade Emmanuel Mahachi said the party's youth league plans to recruit more than 1 million members before the elections. This was such a reception of a few youths who are joining the People's Party. More are coming, and they were just here so that they get to know their leadership, Comrade Mahachi said. We want to acquaint the new members with the party's structure from the cell level up to the presidium. The youth league, he said, had realized that there was growing appetite among the youth to join the party. So the youngsters are important to the party and will empower them so that they participate in economic and national development of their country. We have realized that most youths have become tech savvy. That is why we use social media campaigns. And here we are. A lot more are coming as we gear up for 2023. Provincial Vice Chairperson Comrade Golden Mavesser said youth will deliver victory for the party during the next elections. The party is built on unity, and it is a party that takes care of its youth. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and in the Horn of Africa state of Ethiopia, the Atalieh region of Ethiopia in the Amhara region once again came under Oromo Liberation Front military attack, and that's been taking place since Thursday of last week. Now, it reportedly happened as the security arrangements in the region were withdrawn for deployment in other parts of the region. Atalieh, Efrata, Gidim, Majete, Jill, Timuga, and Oromo administrations in the Amhara region are among targets of the latest radical Oromo military attacks that transpired in the past 2 days. Amhara Media Network reported about it on Friday, and the story was circulating on social media. On Saturday, Amhara Mass Media Agency, a state media in the Amhara region, confirmed the news from residents of Atalieh Town. A resident told AMMA that there was gunfire since 10 p.m. local time on Thursday. At least three people are reported dead, but the government has yet to disclose an official figure. Asked as to who the attackers are, a resident said anonymously, "Who else it could be? It is ONEG, Oromo Liberation Front, had a history of military attempts in Atalieh and other towns in the region. In October of 2019, the organization attempted to take control of the city, only to be crushed by Amhara special forces. It was a nonstop gunfire. We hear grenades and heavy weapons, including machine guns. The security situation continued to be tense on Saturday, a day after the attack. Residents said that they were restricted to their homes and activity in the towns attacked by the OLF seemed to have paused. And finally, African migrants are still being killed in the Mediterranean in attempts to flee the continent to Europe. This has claimed the life of a two-year-old from Mali who was rescued from a migrant boat near Spain's Canary Islands and hospitalized in critical condition. Nonetheless, she has died, according to the health authorities in Spain. The toddler named Naburi suffered a cardiac arrest and was resuscitated by emergency workers on the dock of the Guayan upon arrival on Tuesday. She was being treated at a pediatric hospital in Las Palmas de Gran Canaria, but died earlier today, a spokeswoman with the local health department said. Naburi was among 52 people who departed from Clacker in the western Sahara coast and spent 5 days in the Atlantic Ocean before Spain's Maritime Rescue Service saved the group. Many of the passengers, who included 29 women and 9 children, suffered from severe hypothermia and have required hospital care. The child dramatic rescue made the front page of several Spanish newspapers and highlighted the plight of West Africans fleeing violence or seeking better lives in Europe. There are no words to describe so much pain. Heartfelt thanks to those who have fought to the end to save her life, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez tweeted. It is a knock on the conscience of all of us. The body was 24 months old. Around 2,600 people have survived the dangerous Atlantic crossing and reached the Canaries by boat so far this year. In 2020, some 23,000 people successfully crossed, while 849 were reported dead or missing, according to the United Nations Migrant Agency Missing Migrants Project. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is the electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since that time, the agency has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in various newspapers, magazines and journals and research reports and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and Global Affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you have to do is go to the Pan-African Newswire at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And these programs can be shared with other potential listeners. All you have to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And the links can be shared via email, via blogs and websites, as well as being shared on social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. This is our bioman, Azikiwe. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back. And that was Detroit's own Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, with the tune entitled Rock Steady. And that was in recognition of the National Geographic Network Genius Aretha Franklin series that is running right now over the next several days. And right now we want to move into a news report on some developments on the African continent and the international community. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Second round of official talk between China and the United States conclude in Alaska. We have the latest updates. Tanzania swears in Samia Suluhu Hassan as its first female head of state. And the AstraZeneca vaccine is safe, Europe's drugs regulator says after review. Welcome to Africa Live on CGTN with me, Beatrice Marshall, in Nairobi. Also coming up on the program, in business, close to 50,000 businesses in South Africa's tourism industry are on the verge of collapsing. And in sports, Egypt basks in glory after hosting successful International Shooting World Cup. And we begin in the U.S. state of Alaska, where the second round of official talks between China and the United States has concluded. China's CPC Politburo member Yang Jiechi and State Councilor and Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other U.S. officials. This is the first high-level dialogue between the two sides since U.S. President Joe Biden took office in January. The third round of official talks is scheduled for Friday. Our reporter Nathan King has more.
The first two sessions of these high-level talks are over between the U.S. And China. We have one more session to go on Friday here, local time, in Anchorage, Alaska. One source said to me that the beginning of the session was super spicy. As you know, the Washington up rhetoric and also policy against China in the run-up to these talks, while Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, was touring Asian allies in Tokyo and in Seoul. And they also expanded sanctions against Chinese and Hong Kong officials over the national security law using the Hong Kong Autonomy Act passed on the Trump administration by Congress. And I don't quite know what the strategy was that before the meeting, but as we heard inside the meeting, there was a strong response from China, both from Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi. They reiterated that they didn't feel that was really a good thing to do for a guest inviting another nation to do that on the eve of these high-level talks. Also reiterated that despite U.S. positions that Hong Kong, Xinjiang, issues over Taiwan remain internal sovereignty matters and red lines for essentially China's foreign policy as they have been for a long time. I think what we really need to find out is where the U.S. feels its red lines are in those areas. Things calmed down in the second session after the dinner break. It seemed to be more sort of granular, the discussions going forward. Remember, there are areas of potential cooperation, which we've seen before, over climate change, for example. The Paris Climate Accord would not have happened without the understanding on the Obama administration and Xi Jinping about capping limits and squaring the circle between the developed and the developing world when it comes to emissions and mitigation. So, you know, they can work together. We haven't talked about the DPRK, which of course is still a security concern for all of Northeast Asia and the United States as well. We haven't talked about commerce, the perhaps potential phasing out of tariffs against $350 billion worth of Chinese goods, which were imposed on the Trump administration. We haven't talked about opening up cooperation when it comes to energy here in Alaska. So there are all these things that can happen. Talk about pandemic. There's even talk about a virtual meeting between President Xi Jinping and the new president, U.S. President Joe Biden, on Earth Day, April 22nd. The U.S. is hosting a big climate meeting. That would be a good opportunity as well. So both sides were super spicy, as one of the sources said. but in the room when it began, but there are areas of potential cooperation.
CGTN's Li Jingyi has more on the first round of talks between Chinese and U.S. officials in Alaska.
Top officials from China and the United States have held their first high-level face-to-face meeting since the new U.S. administration took over in January. Relations between the world's two biggest economies are at their lowest in decades due to disagreements over many core issues. There are hopes for a reset in ties, but the opening meeting was marked by strong words exchanged by both sides. Representing China are CBC Politburo member Yang Jiechi and State Councilor and Foreign Minister Wang Yi. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken opened his remarks by saying Beijing needed to return to a rules-based system. He criticized China for what he called economic coercion and for violating international norms. Foreign Minister Wang Yi said the U.S. has been trying to suppress China's legitimate rights and interests in the past few years. Washington's moves have led to serious difficulties in bilateral ties and have harmed global stability and development. He also asked the U.S. to stop meddling China's internal affairs completely, citing the sanctions U.S. imposed on Wednesday over Hong Kong-related issues. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi, in his speech, hit back at the U.S. groundless accusations of China's internal and foreign policies. He said such opening remarks by Blinken were intended to provoke conflict between the two nations. Yang said State Secretary's words were not suitable for diplomatic protocol. He said China exercises proper democracy based on its own conditions, and that China has consistently promoted shared values of mankind, including peace, development, equality, justice, and freedom. He added that instead of judging China's human rights record and democracy, the U.S. should take care of its own problems, including human rights within the country. Yang indicated that China and U.S. have common interests in a range of issues, including the coronavirus pandemic and climate change. He called for both sides to manage their differences properly and on the basis of mutual respect and cooperation.
The United States may have launched a trade war against China under Donald Trump, but the country has still relied on Chinese products to fight COVID-19. Chinese manufacturers have provided stable sources of quality medical products that have been shipped to the United States. Yang Jinghao visits a factory in southwest China that makes the exports.
This factory in southwest China's Chengdu is working around the clock to produce syringes. Most of the products will be exported to the U.S. as the country steps up vaccinations to combat COVID-19. An executive says demand has soared in recent months.
In 2018, when we just started our business in the U.S., the sale of syringe products for the whole year was about 10 million yuan. This year, sales in only the first quarter are expected to exceed 30 million yuan. It's almost tenfold growth.
Established in 1998, the company specializes in manufacturing various disposable medical devices. When tensions between the world's two largest economies were at their height, it also came under pressure.
Though our products were not included in the list of tariffs, many U.S. companies showed concern in cooperating with Chinese distributors as there were too many uncertainties ahead. So we faced obstacles in developing new clients.
But markets are often more honest than politicians. Despite trade frictions, China has been a major provider of medical supplies for the U.S. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says the country has exported more than 43 billion masks to the U.S. since last March, among other products. Behind the booming trade reflects the ambivalent U.S. attitudes towards China. The Biden administration has announced it will extend tariff exclusions on a series of medical products from China until September 30th. Earlier, the Trump administration decided to extend the exclusion until this month.
Currently, the U.S. needs Chinese supplies to save lives and improve health for its people. If your people really need supplies from some country, you definitely should wish those countries to be stable so you can always buy reliable necessities. It makes no sense to disrupt your suppliers when you are really needing them.
Chinese companies are still optimistic about better prospects on the U.S. market.
It's hard for our U.S. clients to find suitable substitutes in the short term. I think China and the U.S. are both rivals and partners. Their business ties are impossible to be completely cut off.
The executive says business people from both countries are expecting a turnaround in bilateral relations so they can carry out closer collaborations. Yang Jinghao, CGTN, Sichuan Province.
Russia has recalled its ambassador to the United States, casting new doubts on the future of bilateral ties. Russian President Vladimir Putin is embroiled in a war of words with his American counterpart. Joe Biden had said Putin would pay a price for reportedly meddling in U.S. elections. He also said he thought Putin was a killer, to which Putin responded, "It takes one to know one." Putin proposed the two sides should have another conversation. In the United States, an officer involved in the investigation into Tuesday's mass shooting in Atlanta is facing accusations of racism. Eight people, including six Asian women, were killed in the attack. The incident has sparked outrage in the United States over anti-Asian hate crimes. William Denslow reports from Atlanta.
The calls to stop attacks against Asian Americans are growing louder and louder. The suspect behind Tuesday's shooting spree says it was fueled by a sex addiction, but investigators are assessing whether racism played its part.
And he was pretty much fed up and kind of at the end of his rope, and yesterday was a really bad day for him, and this is what he did.
Cherokee County Sheriff's Captain Jay Baker's comments Wednesday have been criticized for downplaying the series of shootings that left eight people dead, six of whom were of Asian heritage. He's also accused of promoting a T-shirt with racist messaging about China and COVID-19 on social media last year.
That's a good example as to why hate incidences in America are being underreported, is because incidences like these, we can see that there is some sort of unconscious bias in this police officer, and so it starts to build this distrust.
Baker hasn't immediately commented, but that Facebook account has been deleted.
Many members of the Asian American community here believe Tuesday's shooting is part of a broader issue of rising discrimination nationwide.
Some local residents believe more attention needs to be paid to this issue.
Media coverage is getting more and more on it, so I'm glad about that, but, you know, they can still do better and try to inform other people about what's going on in the Asian community.
There's a big rise in Asian hate crimes in America, and I think that it's a lot of times it is being overlooked.
The president called Tuesday's shooting very troubling. On Friday, President Biden and Vice President Harris will travel to Georgia to speak with Asian American leaders about how the nation can come together after a tragic week. William Denslow, CGTN, Atlanta.
Turning to Myanmar, where local media has reported a deadly attack on a military camp near Yangon, citing local media sources in Myanmar. It said 17 people were killed and 9 were injured. The report said it was carried out by an unknown group in minivans throwing grenades. Officials have not yet released any information about the attack. Myanmar's military took over in early February. There have been widespread protests across the country ever since. Tanzania's Vice President Samia Suluhu Hassan has been sworn in as President of the East African country. Suluhu Hassan was sworn in at State House in the country's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. She takes over the reins following the death of President John Magufuli on Wednesday. Described as a soft-spoken consensus builder, Suluhu Hassan is now the first female head of state in Tanzania. She's also the country's first president born in Zanzibar, the archipelago that forms part of the Union of the Republic of Tanzania. You're watching Africa Live. Still ahead on the program. The AstraZeneca vaccine is safe, Europe's drugs regulator says after review. and we look at how the pandemic is affecting people with disabilities in Kenya.
Africa is a continent of diversity, with varied climates and enchanting geography, and a people so distinct, but with a shared enduring spirit. We are at the heart of the continent to bring you the untold stories.
Let's have a look.
We celebrate Africa as it shapes its own destiny.
I've been sure she's tuning in Cairo,
Juba,
Ethiopia,
Tanzania.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
I try to not let it affect me, but there are days when it does. I'm a human being, and to see patients in a hospital bed and their family members are not there, there's no one there to hold their hand, that human touch, you know?
I just hope everyone can remember that the situation is not permanent and that everything will get better eventually.
Europe's drugs regulator says the AstraZeneca vaccine has been deemed safe following a scientific review. It found no link to reported cases of blood clots, but as CGTN's Tony Waterman reports, confidence in the jab may be lost.
The verdict is in. The European drugs regulator unequivocally saying the AstraZeneca vaccine is safe to use after a week-long investigation into dozens of reported cases of blood clots, which in some cases resulted in death.
This is a safe and effective vaccine. Its benefits in protecting people from COVID-19 with the associated risks of death and hospitalization outweigh the possible risks.
The health regulator also concluded the vaccine didn't increase the overall risk of blood clots, but couldn't rule out a link to more rare and serious side effects. It recommended raising public awareness so health professionals and the public can spot the signs and symptoms. In the past week, 19 European countries have hit pause on the AstraZeneca jab, a move that garnered backlash from some health experts who saw it as an overreaction. Of the 17 million doses administered across the EU and UK, AstraZeneca says fewer than 40 cases of blood clots were reported as of March 8th. Over the same period, thousands have died from COVID-19. The World Health Organization, which will release the findings of its own investigation on Friday, urging people to continue to use the jab.
At this point in time, however, the benefits of the AstraZeneca vaccine far outweigh its risk, and its use should continue to save lives.
While repeatedly deemed safe, public confidence appears shaken. In the past few days, thousands of people in Italy were no-shows for vaccine appointments, while a poll by French broadcaster BFM TV shows trust in the AstraZeneca jab languishing at 20%. Politician.
I do trust AstraZeneca.
After politician.
But it will certainly be Oxford AstraZeneca that I will be having.
Now trying to shore up the public's confidence. Another massive shortfall in deliveries of the AstraZeneca vaccine won't help. The company now expected to deliver only 70 million doses to Europe in the second quarter, down from the 180 million promised.
The chronic shortages have prompted Brussels to act. It announced on Thursday that it's drafting a letter to AstraZeneca to launch the dispute settlement process. If that doesn't work, the two could wind up in court as the global race to vaccinate swirls outside. Tony Waterman, CGTN, Brussels.
Here in Africa, the African Union says countries that have acquired the AstraZeneca vaccine should continue using it to curb the spread of COVID-19, echoing the views of the World Health Organization. Dr. John Ketsangong, who is the director of the Africa CDC, told a news conference that the vaccine's benefits outweigh the risks. The African Union's recommendation comes while more than a dozen European countries had suspended the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine. This amid concerns over the rise of blood clots. The Africa CDC is urging African countries using AstraZeneca doses to monitor and report any adverse reactions. While the African Union says China's continued support for the fight against COVID-19 on the continent and its financing of the construction of the Africa CDC headquarters are signs of the true friendship between Africa and Beijing. Speaking to CGTN, the African Union Commissioner for Social Affairs, along with the director of the Africa CDC, said that the China-backed headquarters would empower the continent. Here is CGTN's Girum Chala with the details.
In December 2020, the historic groundbreaking event marked the beginning of the construction of the China-aided future headquarters of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Addis Ababa-based state-of-the-art building complex is already taking shape here, with construction being expedited. This project is fully funded by the Chinese government, and the African Union officials say this and other COVID-19 related support from Beijing are seen as part of the ever-growing Sino-Africa cooperation in the public health sector.
The support was started even before COVID-19. Since 2016, China is supporting technically and financially the establishment of Africa CDC. China also is supporting in building the headquarters of Africa CDC.
Amira El Fadil also said the China CDC has been highly supportive of its African counterpart.
China CDC is supporting Africa CDC by seconding experts that are working with our Africa CDC staff. They are supporting also the training and the capacity building of our staff. They are supporting us financially.
Africa CDC is extensively...
Dr. John Nkengasong, the director of Africa CDC, says the prospect of having the new headquarters is exciting.
We continue to be very excited with the prospects of that, having our own headquarters, our own campus, and we look forward to the day that we invite you and have this press conference live from the new headquarters of the Africa CDC in Addis Ababa.
The landmark Africa CDC headquarters project covers an area of 90,000 square meters and has a total construction area of nearly 40,000 square meters. It's massive and is expected to be completed within 25 months. It will be equipped with modern office buildings, high-end laboratories and accessories. The future headquarters of the Africa CDC will be another landmark in Ethiopia's capital. In addition to the African Union headquarters, China's extensive support for Africa and more particularly the continent CDC has been appreciated by officials.
China has been supporting us, Africa CDC, extensively in the areas of diagnostics, in the areas of personal protective equipment.
In the future, the Africa CDC headquarters is expected to serve as a continental center for research and excellence. Girum Chala, CGTN, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Reports continue to indicate that people in need of special care are facing compounded difficulties during the pandemic. In Kenya's city of Kisumu, the pandemic is especially taking a toll on people with disabilities. CGTN's Daniel Arap Moy reports.
Stephen Onyango was born healthy until 1998 when he suffered from cerebral malaria and immediately became blind. Onyango now needs help from others for all his daily activities.
I cannot wash my hand without my guide. I cannot keep distance without my guide. I cannot walk to the market without my guide. Even go to the toilet, I cannot go to the toilet without my guide.
Onyango says the scariest part about the pandemic isn't the infection itself, but isolation from family and friends. For many of those like Onyango, with visual impairment or physical disabilities, the pandemic has thrown open a host of unique challenges.
As a person with a physical disability, when you tell me do not touch, then it's like you are infringing on my rights, because I cannot stand without holding. I cannot stand or get into a vehicle without holding any surface. So nobody considered that when COVID started and the rules were laid down.
All these, they say, have risen from the absence of touch, the primary sense around which their world is built and experienced.
Persons with disabilities are facing various challenges, mostly caused by non-inclusive restriction policies and programs rather than the virus itself.
The deaf, we are talking, and somebody's having a mask. The deaf are reading people's lips, so you realize that he cannot get information without reading your lips.
But it isn't just during the coronavirus that people with disabilities are facing challenges. Many have been unable to access the much-needed services even before the outbreak.
They have been, the entire, for example, narrative has not been inclusive, and that's the work, for example, us as an organization, we did step up to provide that support. So, for example, we had a specific conversation with the like of African CDC to ensure that the guidelines they are offered, they are also inclusive.
Kenyan government last year launched a cash transfer for persons with severe disabilities aimed at improving their livelihoods as well as reducing the negative impact of COVID-19. Daniel Arap Moi, CGTN, Kisumu, Kenya.
Zimbabwe's government is expecting a bumper maize harvest, which could be three times higher than the amount produced during the drought-hit 2019-2020 season. CGTN's Farai Mwakutuya reports on what this means for the country, which has been battling food insecurity.
Davidson Gambinga began planting his maize crop in November 2020, hoping that forecasts of an above-average rainy season would materialize. They did, and today he's expecting to reap over 30 tons, his biggest harvest in years.
Usually the driest months of the season are January and February, but this year they had the most rainfall. It has been such a good season all over the country that the grain marketing board may not have enough space to store all the grain.
Total national output is estimated to reach at least 2.5 million metric tons.
Government plans to raise 65 billion Zimbabwe dollars, that's about 783 million US, to buy up 1.8 million tons of maize.
That'll be enough to meet annual consumption, and what's left over could be stored in the National Grain Reserve.
This season is very important because it then guarantees that we're going to have food for this coming 12 months, but we are also going to have food in the event of a drought. So the economy, what it means to the economy is that normally when we have a deficit, we will have to import. And importing means foreign currency, use of foreign currency reserves, and that's a drain on the fiscus. But this is an import substitution.
The good harvest will also lower the number of people requiring food and humanitarian aid, currently estimated to be over 5 million by the United Nations World Food Programme.
Given that we have this situation where we're looking at the good harvest and our future food assistance during the lean season will be in all likelihood much lower, it will open up the opportunity for WFP and many other agencies to continue refocusing their investments towards resilience building, towards livelihoods, to really help bolster that capacity for those communities and households to better live with shocks going forward.
Zimbabwe has predicted strong economic growth of 7.4% in 2021, mainly on the back of the rebound of the mainstay agriculture sector. Farai Mwakutuya, CGTN, Mazowe, Zimbabwe.
A green technology has been around for years now, but it's not really caught on. Carbon capture and storage, or CCS, involves capturing waste carbon dioxide. The CO2 is then safely deposited before it enters into the atmosphere, limiting greenhouse gas emissions. CCS is now experiencing a second spring in China thanks to technological advances and new policy approaches. Sun Ye has more.
It could be the solution that makes all the difference. Gao Shiwang is behind this next-generation chemical that's crucial to carbon capture, a technology that's often used by traditional fossil fuel plants to manage their carbon dioxide emissions, but is often complained for not being cost-effective enough.
When this absorbent interacts with carbon dioxide, it breaks into two layers. The one where carbon dioxide concentrates can be set apart and processed, and the other half can be used to capture carbon dioxide again. Using this absorbent could cut as much as 40% of heat consumption compared with previous additions.
The solution is being put to test in one of Huaneng's thermal power plants. So far, it's managing to capture at least 1,000 tons a year.
We are next trying to put the solution to use in the 120,000-ton facility in Shanghai. And if that goes well, it will become the solution for many more of our projects.
But for now, even the country's largest carbon capture and storage facility is still small scale, especially compared with the country's ambitious green goal of having its carbon emission peak by the year 2030 and becoming carbon neutral by the year 2060.
Before, carbon capture and storage were most often used in projects just to test if the technology was viable. But now with the 2030 and 2060 goals, CCS needs to aim for commercialization and an economy of scale. That's partly why the 14th five-year plan has called for CCS projects to be a focus.
John expects a mature CCS technology to be a green solution not only for fossil fuel power plants, but also cement factories, steel makers, and other industries that need to rein in greenhouse gas emissions. Sun Ye, CGTN, Beijing.
And here's a quick recap of our headlines this hour. The second round of official talks between China and the United States has concluded. China's CPC Politburo member Yang Jiechi and State Councilor and Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other U.S. officials. This is the first high-level dialogue between the two sides since U.S. President Joe Biden took office in January. The third round of official talks is scheduled for a Friday. Tanzania's Vice President Samia Suluhu Hassan has been sworn in as President of the East African country. Suluhu Hassan was sworn in at State House in the country's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. She takes over the reins following the death of President John Magufuli on Wednesday. Described as a soft-spoken consensus builder, Suluhu Hassan is now the first female head of state in Tanzania. She's also the country's first president born in Zanzibar, the archipelago that forms a part of the Union of the Republic of Tanzania. Europe's drugs regulator says the AstraZeneca vaccine has been deemed safe. This follows a week-long investigation into dozens of reported cases of blood clots, which in some cases resulted in death. The investigation found no links to reported cases of blood clots. And that's a look at your headlines. But let's now take a look at your business news. Here's what's ahead. Businesses in South Africa's tourism industry are on the verge of collapse. And Egypt's government plans to increase spending to boost incomes amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
Africa is the nexus of enterprise, and global business will tell you why it matters.
From the mega investment projects to multi-billion dollar mergers and acquisitions.
Africa today collects, just in terms of revenues from taxes alone, $545 billion a year. If you take 10% of that and you devote it to the energy sector, problem solved.
All this on Global Business, weekdays at this time on CGTN.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
South Africa now, where around 50,000 tourism businesses have either temporarily or permanently closed due to the pandemic. That's according to tourism officials, who point to a huge drop in tourist numbers as the reason. In Cape Town's tourism hotspot of Hout Bay, that decline has driven many out of business. However, some are managing to stay afloat. CGTN's Travers Andrews has more with his report.
Over the last 12 months, the tourism industry in Cape Town's Hout Bay has grind to a halt due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Many businesses have either closed or pivoted, including local pizzeria Massimo's, who caters to both locals and tourists. With a massive drop in revenue due to various levels of lockdown, the restaurant had to find creative ways to stay open.
We thought out of the box. We decided to do different things when we were closed, when we were only allowed to reopen partially. So we decided to do the frozen pizzas, the frozen meals, the spirity, which is our liquors. So all together it has helped us to survive and to keep all the stuff.
The business now operates at 80% of pre-COVID-19 levels and is increasing the range of its products to keep staff employed. Its new line of spirits and food stands as testament to the new opportunities that the pandemic has also unlocked.
Eventually we may go back to the original situation, but it will be a very long time. And I think now people, they also get the idea that they can eat well staying home, especially with the good quality that we offer. So it's a good alternative. And also before we were limited to people that could drive to us in Hout Bay. Hout Bay is a bit isolated, a village.
While tourism businesses in Hout Bay rely heavily on an influx of tourists, an 81.2% drop in visitors over the festive season has left many out of pocket. Over the last 12 months, many businesses in Hout Bay have struggled due to a lack of tourists. And the earliest relief could come in the fourth quarter of this year, when the country embarks on a far broader vaccine rollout program.
It is important that our government vaccinate as many people as possible, specifically those with comorbidities, and roll that program out as quickly as possible so that international tourists would feel safe and know that we have herd immunity.
For now, air connectivity also remains restricted, so little to no tourists are arriving. But the local market is supporting the businesses in what remains a tough economic environment. That's Andrew, CGTN, Cape Town.
Africa's largest supermarket chain posted an 18% jump in trading profit for the second half of 2020, despite a turbulent year for the retail industry. ShopRite has been reviewing its long-term options across Africa over the past year. That's as currency devaluations, lower commodity prices and high inflation hit household incomes and weighed on earnings. From Johannesburg, here's Sumitra Naidu.
It was a stellar performance considering all the restrictions around COVID-19. ShopRite lost 79 days of trade in its home base during the liquor bans in 2020, but its grocery stores made up for the losses. Sales in its biggest market, South Africa, came in 5.6% higher.
We gained market share uninterrupted for 22 months now, to the value of 1.3 billion on top of last year's 1.4 billion. In particular, in the fresh food and convenience section of the market, we gained another 400 million in market share. If you exclude liquor in the South African business, we grew the turnover by 7.8%.
ShopRite wasn't as successful in the rest of Africa as COVID-19 constrained trade. Its non-RSA operations fell 8.4%. Angola was hard hit as it also had to deal with its weak currency. Sales there and in Zambia declined over 15%. Namibia and Mozambique also recorded lower sales growth.
Africa at the moment remains a tale of devaluing currencies. So this is at the current point in time. I don't know what's going to happen over the next 10 years. It doesn't mean that we would not reinvest again, but maybe with a different operating model.
The last of its stores in Kenya have been closed and the sale of its stores in Nigeria is almost complete.
We don't have a strategy to withdraw from the continent at all. What we did was to look at our individual investments country by country to ensure that we do give our shareholders the return that they require. One can't indefinitely subsidize the foreign operations with this African rand. We are awaiting final approval from the equivalent of the Competition Commission in Nigeria for that sale. We will continue to support the business going forward on a franchise basis in terms of the brand, systems, and management over the next 5 years.
Shoprite remains the largest private sector employer in South Africa with over 140,000 employees. The group managed to create another 4,300 jobs in 2020, helping with the onslaught of joblessness in South Africa. Samish Renadu, CGTN, Johannesburg.
One of Kenya's top two banks, KCB, has reported a 22% decline in net earnings for the 2020 fiscal year to $178 million. The bank's stock of non-performing loans made up 14.7% of its entire loan book. That was marginally higher than the industry average of 14.1% and a reflection of the economic damage inflicted by the pandemic on the Kenyan economy, where 77% of the bank's assets are located. CEO Joshua Oigara argued that despite the uncertain outlook, there is progress being made in reducing KCB's stock of non-performing loans.
You have to be two-dimensional in this view. One is the period it's taking for us to be able to be confident about COVID, and number two, some sectors being reopened. So you have some sectors which are a bit held back today, maybe like in aviation, you haven't traveling as much. Hotels, we don't have as many tourists. You know, schools took longer to open. So we've done 106 billion by quarter four. But by now, almost 30 billion of those have actually gone back to normal loans. So we have had almost a 35% recovery, if you ask me. And so I'm confident. And so now we're down to almost 70 billion, 72 billion to be exact. So you can see some progress. Yeah, so we see hotels, hospitality industry, but classify that. Some of our customers in manufacturing and aviation, that which is, and also some real estate, we see some delayed recovery. But on trade, on other segments like education, financial institutions, on energy, we see, that's already picking up.
The Egyptian government is planning to increase spending in the 2021-2022 fiscal budget that goes into effect in July. This is in a bid to boost the incomes of millions of Egyptians and to cushion households from the COVID-induced economic slowdown. The new spending increases the minimum wage for public sector employees, pensions and civil servant salaries, with the monthly minimum wage of civil servants set to increase by 20%. From Cairo, here's Yasser Hakim.
The newly announced budget reflects the state's policies to deal with the adverse effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Economic growth rate is forecast to remain below the pre-COVID target of 5.5%, although total spending is set to rise by 9% year on year. Most of it is aimed at boosting social services.
We see a big increase in expenditure in education, the school and university levels, as well as the same increase in spending on the health sector. This goes with President Sisi's pledge in his second term in office to overhaul and upgrade the health and education services in the country with the aim to improve the quality of life for Egyptians.
Expenses will also be geared towards raising salaries and pensions, increasing social welfare programs for the poor and emergency aid packages for struggling businesses and institutions. The government is not eyeing any tax hikes in the 2021-2022 fiscal year, but it expects revenues to jump by 13%. This is in spite of the significant drop in important sources of income, such as tourism and exports, which have been battered by the pandemic.
Though he announced no tax increase, the government is seeking to improve tax collection management with better trained tax collectors, incentives for taxpayers, and introducing technology to reduce tax evasion. Another important revenue stream will come from investments in several sectors such as real estate, which is picking up quickly and attracting a lot of investors. We have huge mega projects, building new cities, roads, transport, industrial zones, attracting investments in multiple industries, including renewable energy projects and digital transformation.
Numbers show optimism of a recovery from the pandemic next year, with the budget surplus forecast to more than double, pushing deficit down by 1.2% of GDP. Yasser Hakim for CGTN, Cairo.
Nigeria's new policy that's aimed at boosting the nation's foreign reserve is fast gaining traction. The Naira for Dollar plan, as it's widely known, gives an incentive of 5 Naira for every US dollar remitted through formal channels. As CGTN's Kelechi Emekalam tells us, the country's central bank hopes it will attract more remittances from its diaspora to boost foreign currency liquidity.
Businessman Babatunde Adetiba has been receiving monies from overseas for more than 8 years now. In the past, he used unofficial channels for his foreign transactions in order to boost his exchange rates. Diaspora remittances were paid in the local currency, the Naira, and at a discounted rate.
Right now, we receive money through Central Bank of Nigeria licensed international money transfer organizations called IMTOs. Well, that's how we receive our monies now, but before now, we have other channels that enable us to get effective rates.
But the new central bank scheme does not only ensure remittances are received in the originating currency, it also offers a 5 Naira incentive for every US dollar received through formal channels. Now Babatunde is cashing in on the opportunity.
It's one of the best incentives that Central Bank has given in a long time, and it's been effective. What that means is that apart from getting the effective exchange rates for the money sent, you get an extra 5 Naira.
About 13 million Nigerians live abroad. That's apart from those living in other African countries. That's why Nigeria benefits massively from diaspora remittances surpassing oil revenue. International professional firm PricewaterhouseCoopers projects that Nigeria's migrant revenues could grow to $29.8 billion in 2021. The firm estimates that diaspora flows into Nigeria totaled $23.63 billion in 2018, representing 6.1% of its GDP. The central bank's Naira for Dollar seeks to strengthen diaspora inflows and gradually eliminate informal channels of receiving funds. But economists say there are loopholes in the scheme. Currently, the exchange rate in the black market is 480 Naira to $1, far much higher than the central bank's approved rate of 380 Naira to $1. Experts say for the scheme to thrive, the government may need to either crash the black market or match its rate. Nigeria's external reserve fell from $36.19 billion at the beginning of February to $34.7 billion in the first week of March. The Naira for Dollar scheme is meant to help boost the reserves, and the quick fix policy will last for the next 2 months. Kelechi Emekalam, CGTN Abuja, Nigeria.
A Chinese construction machinery manufacturing company, XCMG, is making inroads into Africa by contributing to the development of infrastructure while also training locals. In recent years, the company has sold heavy machinery and continues to provide service and spare parts for the machines used in infrastructure development projects on the continent. Wolkisa Nyabwa tells us more.
Bit by painstaking bit, Nairobi's expressway is taking shape. Construction workers working round the clock are making sure of this, and mingled with the sights and sounds of the busy Mombasa road are the sounds from the heavy machinery moving the project forward. Many of these machines come from the XCMG company, a heavy machinery manufacturing company that was founded in 1943 in China. In 2017, XCMG initiated an upgraded plan for the overseas service and spare parts network, establishing independent service and spare parts centers to increase support for dealers. A year later, it opened its first direct regional spare parts center in Nairobi to serve businesses in East Africa.
We think, you know, Kenya is a very potential good market. It's developing very fast. We are very proud to be one of the, to be one of the partners in the process of the Kenya's development.
The company has also set up bases in Guinea, Nigeria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. It is from such investments that the company's involvement in projects such as Nairobi's groundbreaking expressway has arisen.
we can see a very great potential for, you know, for China and Africa countries. It's for the mutual complementary, you know, growth together. We have the experience of construction technology and high-end construction equipment. And also, you need a lot of infrastructure, and we can mutually, you know, benefit. We are very proud of the, you know, the Africa and the China friendship and cooperation.
This is one example of the ways in which China-Africa cooperation is yielding benefits for both sides. In this case, it has also led to a transfer of skills and knowledge.
There are a lot of people who are learning a lot, especially the manual work. There are some who came here without some experience, and they are being taught. There are some machines which are also, I think they are new in Kenya as well. And the training they give them here, I think in future they'll be the ones who will be running all those stuff. For me personally, I think I'm sharpening more of my language.
There are more than 200,000 pieces of XCMG equipment in use outside China at present. Kenya alone has over 2,000 XCMG machines, each of these playing a part in building Africa's infrastructure. Wilkis Anyabwa, CGTN, Nairobi.
Let's now take a look at your sports news. Here's what's ahead. Egypt basks in glory after hosting a successful International Shooting World Cup.
How would you create your legend? On the field. On the tracks. In the arenas of Africa. Were you born to be a player? Could this moment be yours?
Welcome back. And that was news reports from around the world, from Africa and also from Asia, U.S.-China relations. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And we are broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit in these early morning hours of Monday, March 22nd, 2021. And we'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment on Women's History Month with a focus on the black legendary vocalist, Ruby Elzy. We'll be back.
This program is based upon the book Black Diva of the 30s, The Life of Ruby Elzy by David E. Weaver, published by the University Press of Mississippi. Archival recordings for this program were also provided by Mr. Weaver.
George Gershwin Memorial Concert. In this, the starlit setting of the Hollywood Bowl, thousands of music lovers have gathered to honor the memory of this famous American composer. The world's great artists who have for many seasons past received tribute here, tonight, join this vast audience to pay tribute. The tribute of friendship, appreciation, and of admiration for one man, George Gershwin.
On September 8, 1937, a throng of people estimated at 22,000 pushed up Highland Avenue and streamed into the Hollywood Bowl, causing a traffic jam which brought traffic to a crawl in all directions. That crowd, plus scores more listening on CBS, affiliates in Canada, and around the world on shortwave, had gathered to honor the memory of George Gershwin, who had died 2 months earlier at the age of 38 after emergency surgery for a brain tumor. Among those performers on hand for the Gershwin Memorial Concert were Anne Brown, Todd Duncan, and Ruby Elzy, Gershwin's hand-picked choices for the roles of Bess, Porgy, and Serena in the original production of Porgy and Bess.
And now the 40 members of the Hall Johnson Choir are being applauded as they take their places on the stage. This unusual musical organization is perhaps the best-known Negro choir in America today. They have traveled extensively over the United States and Europe, and have worked in motion pictures. The choir is arranged in semicircle in front of the orchestra and will be heard with the principals of the original New York production of Porgy and Bess, who were brought to Hollywood especially for this concert. Ruby Elzy sings, "My Man's Gone Now."
You're hearing one of the few surviving recordings of Ruby Elzy singing My Man's Gone Now, a performance at the 1937 Memorial Tribute to George Gershwin, broadcast on CBS Radio barely 2 months after Gershwin's death from a brain tumor. Ruby Elzy would live but six more years before she, too, would be gone. She was preparing for her opera debut in Verdi's Aida when she died suddenly in a Detroit hospital after surgery to remove a benign tumor. She was 35. What she could have gone on to accomplish is pure speculation, but what she achieved in her brief life was nothing short of miraculous. During those 6 years, she would perform in concert halls and nightclubs from coast to coast, be a headliner at Harlem's Apollo Theater, perform on NBC's Town Hall Tonight with host Fred Allen, and even perform for the Roosevelts in the White House.
After her performance in the film Birth of the Blues with Bing Crosby and Mary Martin, critics would say, Ruby Elsie sings St. Louis blues like an angel from heaven. Ruby Elsie's splendid singing lifts the sequence far above the rest of a routine musical comedy. In this cast is Ruby Elsie, whose rendition of St. Louis blues will be remembered as long as the song will live. In November 1941, Ruby appeared on a nationwide broadcast from Hollywood to promote Birth of the Blues. Bing Crosby introduced her.
Back in 1914, a couple of years before the original Dixieland Jazz Band gave New York the hot foot, a man down in Memphis was committing an assortment of notes to paper, possibly as blue a collection of chords, cadenzas, and cacophony as a breathless public has ever heard. The man's name was W.C. Handy, and he enjoys the notable distinction of being the first man ever to put blues music on paper. And though it wasn't his first blues tune, it was, and I guess it still is, by far his greatest. We're privileged in our picture to have a truly great artist give this tune the kind of a performance that it deserves. And Ruby Elsie is with us again tonight to sing St. Louis Blues.
Film success, Crosby signed Ruby to the agency headed by his brother to represent her for future film work. After all of this praise for her remarkable abilities, it would be nearly 60 years before the spotlight would once again shine on this talented singer and performer. But who was Ruby Elsie? What was she like? And how in the early 1920s does a young black woman who spends her days helping her mama with washing and ironing for well-to-do white families, working in the garden, tending to her brothers and sisters, and dreaming of a singing career, escape the bonds of Jim Crow and get from Pontotoc, Mississippi to stages in Washington, D.C., Boston, and New York City?
Trouble I see, Lord.
much of Ruby's strength and determination to, quote, sing in a big hall before a large group of people came from her mother, Emma, who had a, quote, iron will, boundless faith, and an almost superhuman capacity for hard work. Ruby saw what her mother endured to get them through rough times, that in the face of difficult obstacles, she worked harder and became more determined. So when her mother told her, "Ruby, if being a singer is what you really want to do, then just keep praying and someday God will open the door for you to do it," that was the glimmer of hope Ruby needed. At the same time Ruby was dreaming of singing in a big hall, George Gershwin was developing the musical voice which would come to be loved by millions. As a youngster, George Gershwin was a tough kid who, as they might have said at the time, took nothing off of nobody. Yet a few notes of music floating out of an open window was enough to grab young George's attention, transforming him from a young street-smart kid to a boy totally enraptured by music. It was as if George Gershwin and Ruby Elsie, with, by most estimates, absolutely no chance of ever crossing paths, were being guided toward an intersection where their lives were destined to become permanently intertwined. George began music lessons in 1911 when he was 13 years old. By the time he was 15, he'd left school to become a Tin Pan Alley song plugger, all the while working to get his own music heard. At the same time, Ruby Elsie's musical talents were also developing, but in a completely different setting. I know the Lord and laid his hands on me. Oh, I know the Lord. I know the Lord. I know the Lord. Ruby was the first child of Emma and Charles Elsie, born in the small northern Mississippi town of Pontotoc. Emma sang soprano in the choir at McDonald Methodist Church. It wouldn't be long before Ruby would display her incredible gift in that small southern town. On a spring day in 1912, the choir had begun a hymn when suddenly a child's voice floated above all the others. 4-year-old Ruby was singing her heart out from the front pew. The congregation chuckled at first, but their laughter quickly subsided as they realized that the youngster had a voice with power and sweetness far beyond her years. By the end of the hymn, applause and shouts of hallelujah rang out. Ruby had made her debut. Ruby's life was typical for the black residents of the South. Her daddy cooked meals at a local mill, while her mama taught 5 grades at the Pontotoc Colored School, worked in the cotton fields from the time school let out at noon until sunset. Then, after feeding her family and getting them to bed, Emma did laundry for several local white families into the wee hours of the morning. As Ruby grew up, she began to help her mom with the chores and caring for her brother and sisters. As she delivered laundry around town, Ruby sang. Thank you. It's 1919. George Gershwin bursts onto the music scene when Al Jolson records Swanee.
Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee.
11-year-old Ruby is busy delivering laundry around Pontotoc, Mississippi, singing at the top of her lungs and, most likely, performing on stages all across the country in her mind.
Waiting for me, praying for me.
It seemed nothing was going to stand in Ruby's way in the quest of her dream. She was too young to attend Rust High School, which required their students to be at least 15 years old to enroll, and she had no money for tuition. But Ruby's mother, Emma, somehow convinced school officials to allow 11-year-old Ruby to attend on a work scholarship.
On the journey now, Mount Zion, on the journey now, Mount Zion, well, it would take nothing, Mount Zion, for my journey now, Mount Zion.
Ruby blossomed at Rust, growing into a popular, beautiful young lady. She was, in the words of one fellow student, most noted for making eyes. It would be her eyes many of her classmates would notice first when she moved north to Columbus, Ohio. Madge Guthrie was a classmate of Ruby's at Ohio State.
It was her eyes as much as her smile. It was a good smile, but she had sparkly eyes, and she was aware of everything, you know. You just had the impression that here is somebody who was right into the moment, always.
Well, my soul got happy, and I stayed all day, Mount Zion. On the journey now, Mount Zion, I'm on the journey now, Mount Zion. The wind won't take nothing, Mount Zion, for my journey now, Mount Zion. You can talk about me just as much as you please. Well, we'll talk about you when I get on my knees, Mount Zion. On the journey now, Mount Zion, I'm on the journey now, Mount Zion. Well, it wouldn't take nothing, Mount Zion, for my journey.
You could ask 100 people how Ruby Elsie wound up a student at Ohio State University, learning how to read music under the guidance of Royal Hughes, who was the head of OSU's fledgling music department. Some would say fate. Some would say coincidence or luck. Both Ruby and her mother Emma would be quick to tell you that nothing happens by accident. However you see it, Ruby's life was about to change. One person came into her life and changed it forever.
It was Dr. McCracken, and he wasn't even in the music department, I don't think. I think that he just met her there, but he did recognize genius when he saw it and knew what to do about it. Didn't just say, like most of us would, oh, it's too bad somebody doesn't do something about this woman, and he really did.
Didn't it rain?
Ruby's freshman year at Rust College. George Gershwin's Someone to Watch Over Me from the Broadway musical O.K. would climb to number 2 on the charts. That same year, Dr. Charles C. McCracken, professor of school administration at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, traveled to Rust College as part of a committee appointed to study Negro schools and colleges in the South. It was during a meeting with Dr. McCoy that Dr. McCracken first heard Ruby's voice. On a warm spring day in Mississippi, the windows were open, and the men were in the midst of a meeting. As usual, Ruby was singing.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
As her voice floated through the open office window, Dr. McCracken found it increasingly difficult to concentrate, and his companion on the trip, Dr. Walter C. John from the Office of Education in Washington, D.C., finally threw down his pencil and said, "Dr. McCoy, either we make that girl stop singing or bring her in here to sing for us." When she was asked if she minded if someone listened in on her rehearsal, her smile and warmth struck an immediate chord with Dr. McCracken. Dr. McCracken's son, Ed, was 5 years old when Ruby arrived in Columbus and recalls his dad's reaction the first time he met Ruby.
There are people who walk in and have a command appearance, and are they're just the dominant feature in the room. And Ruby had that in her domain and as a person. And when she walked in, she was just somebody special. It was in her eyes. I mean, you knew that she was a loving person, that she liked everybody unless they did something terrible, and then she usually accommodate that. She had that sense of humor that just was unquenchable. I mean, it just made people love her.
C.C. McCracken would spend the rest of the evening learning about Ruby's background, how she was doing in school, her mother's determination that Ruby get an education, and most of all, her deep desire to become a singer. Neither man felt they had the connections or the money to help Ruby realize her dream. What a shame, they thought, that nothing could be done to help such a gifted young lady. It appeared Ruby Elsie was destined to suffer the same fate as many young blacks in the South, unfulfilled dreams. But C.C. McCracken was a resourceful man. Dr. McCracken knew Ruby deserved the chance to realize her dreams. He just wasn't exactly sure how to go about helping her. When Dr. McCracken asked Ruby if she'd be interested in going north to study and develop her voice, if he could arrange it, she was understandably cautious, but it was decided Ruby would talk to her mother about it, and Dr. McCracken would begin laying the groundwork for Ruby Elsie to attend Ohio State University. If the thought of a poor but gifted black girl living under the cloud of Jim Crow, being handpicked by George Gershwin, was beyond what people could imagine, who would ever have thought a Harvard-educated professor would become her mentor and her biggest promoter? And how in the world would she get to Columbus? a black person was not going to be allowed to travel alone by train. But there was a way. David Weaver, author of Ruby Elsie, Black Diva of the 30s, tells the story.
Fortunately, one of the women who was the headmistress at Rust College, Ella Becker, was from Mansfield, Ohio, and she was coming to spend the summer with her family. How is she going to travel? In the Deep South, blacks could not travel on trains. The one way that blacks were able to travel was posing as Ella Becker's maid. So she carried her baggage to the thing and made it through the Deep South and made it up here to Columbus, Ohio in June of 1927.
Just one of many seemingly insurmountable odds Dr. McCracken helped Ruby overcome. Anne Brown, who would later be cast in the role of Bess in the original production of Porgy and Bess, had a different experience.
I experienced difficulties too, but not exactly of the same kind. Ruby was obviously black. I was not obviously black, and so I very often did what people in those days called passing, without actually meaning to do so either. But if I bought a ticket on a train to Texas and they gave me a seat, I went and took it. And only if someone came up and recognized my background and then reported, I use that word in quotation marks, to someone at the head of the train, they might come and ask me to please get out of that train or go to another car or sit in the back or something like that.
So Ruby now has a way to get to the Ohio State campus and has a place to stay. Now Dr. McCracken has to hope that other members of the administration see the same promise that he saw in Ruby. There were a number of questions to be answered. Could she be admitted to the university? How was her voice? Dr. McCracken wanted to have Ruby tested by Dr. Royal Hughes. The two men lived across the street from one another on East Lane Avenue. So the morning after Ruby arrived in Columbus, Dr. Hughes crossed Lane Avenue to hear Ruby sing. In Dr. Hughes's mind, Ruby already had one strike against her. She didn't actually read music.
She had an innate ear, an instinct for music, and of course, blessed with a natural voice, but she had had no training, no musical training even.
And Dr. Hughes could have just said, you know, I don't have time to mess with this.
That's right, no. Dr. McCracken's wife, who was a very fine accompanist, Cleo McCracken, accompanied Ruby on this Saturday morning. Ruby dresses in her Rust College uniform, which is very much like a little sailor suit, a pleated skirt, a jumper, and a little navy tie, and proceeds to sing two spirituals, which of course I'm sure he was expecting, you know, okay. But then when she announces that her third song is going to be the Shadow Song from Meyerbeer's Dinora, the smile left his face, and he whispered to Dr. McCracken, there's no way a girl who's had no training, who can't even read music, can possibly sing a song that difficult. Ruby proceeded to sing. Hughes was so excited, he had Mrs. McCracken get up, and he proceeded to accompany Ruby for the rest of the time and ask her to do these things. He was floored. She had learned the way that many other singers learn through rote, through listening.
Oh.
Columbus, Ohio was a very active musical town in the late 20s, with orchestras, opera companies, and concert series taking place regularly. Royal Hughes proceeded to call upon 30 of the most accomplished musicians in Columbus to hear Ruby perform in his home the next evening. After Ruby performed her brief program, a particular musician made a beeline for Dr. Hughes.
There was one woman in particular, a violinist with not the Columbus Symphony that we have today, but an orchestra which back then was known also as the Columbus Symphony Orchestra. This woman was the principal violinist and was known to be very critical in her opinion of other musicians. And McCracken watched her very carefully as she was listening. And when the concert finished, McCracken said, "This woman sprung up immediately, made a beeline straight to me, and I was bracing myself to hear this barrage of whatever she was going to say." And the woman pumped his hand vigorously and said, "Whatever you do, don't send that girl back to Mississippi. She has an extraordinary voice and the personality to sell herself to any audience."
The career of Ruby Elzey, soprano, had begun in the living room of Dr. Royal Hughes that June evening in 1927. 16 years later, to the day, Ruby would give her final public performance of Porgy and Bess.
Welcome back. And that was part one of the legacy, life, and contributions of the black legendary singer Ruby Elzey from the state of Mississippi during the early 20th century. And that's going to be it for our program today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and we have been broadcasting on the late hour of Sunday, March 21st, and the early morning hours of Monday, March 22nd, 2021, broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you want to have access to this program, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And not only can you have access to today's program for Sunday, March 21st, and Monday, March 22nd, 2021, but well over 1,000 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal. And this is Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, and you can read the Pan-African Newswire 7 days a week, 24 hours a day at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And this is Viomea Zikawe. We'll be closing out our program with the music of the legendary Clifford Brown, Max Roach quintet from the mid-1950s. This is Viomea Zikawe signing off, and have a beautiful week. Thank you.
We'll be right back.